This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
It's really very, very nice to be here in New Mexico and in Albuquerque because it is one part of the United States that I feel very particularly strongly about, the landscape and the whole sense of the country here. And I'm very grateful to all of you for making it possible for me to be here. I can hardly stand up here and talk about poetry without mentioning at least two people whose presences I'm very conscious of as poets here. One is Charles Tomlinson, who was here last year and whose work I admire so very much and who many of you must have heard speak. And also Robert Creeley, who you have just seen here, and whose work has, I have owed so much to his poetry, to his example, and I can't stand here without mentioning this too. Now I'm stuck with my title because 2 weeks ago I thought that maybe I could come up with a nice title for this, and Migrant Birds and Tattle Thieves sounded rather, well, it seemed rather clever 2 weeks ago, but I'm not so sure now how much it's got to do with this evening, but I have some justification for it because I'm sort of a migrant bird myself, and the magazine I published a few years ago and the pamphlets we've put out has been under the name of Migrant. And the cattle thieves part, I'm descendant of cattle thieves. The Turnbulls come from the borders between England and Scotland, just on the Scottish side of the border in the Tweed Valley. And back in about 1300, one of the kings of Scotland came down there near Jedburgh and Melrose and rounded up all the Turnbulls in a long line, all the male members of the family group, and then, by counting off, hanged every tenth man, just to remind them that they shouldn't do so much cattle thieving as they had been doing. But I also have another meaning in the term because I have an idea that a good writer is entitled to be a cattle thief of sorts, that if he sees some good ideas over the border that will improve the breed of his own stock, I think a good writer should help himself and use what he can, when and where he can. And this was one of the thoughts behind when we started Migrant. I had just left Worcester in England to come to California and had a very good friend there. And we had shared many ideas together. And many of our feelings about poetry and the kind of poetry we were interested in, there was no magazine, particularly in England, that gave any scope or outlet for this particular emphasis. And if I talk a little bit this evening about these particular poets, this isn't to deny what a lot of other people there have achieved, and there are many other writers whose work I also admire, but these are ones that I was particularly interested in. And we started Migrant just as a kind of fishing, thinking, well, if there's the two of us who are interested in this kind of poetry, surely there must be other people around. Maybe if we let out our lines a little bit, we might make contact with a few. And so we put out 8 issues of really a very modest magazine. And we were very lucky, at least by our scores. And we got in touch with several people there whose work had as yet been unpublished, and some of whom I'm going to read to you tonight. And I'm going to read from 3 of these poets, and after that I'll stop for a few minutes and let you talk and ask questions if you like. Then I'll go on and read some of my own poems. And the first of these poets is a Scottish writer, Ian Hamilton Finlay. And this was a little pamphlet of his poems that we put out. And I'd tell you a little bit about Finlay before I read some of his poems. He He was born in Glasgow and grew up there and led rather an uncertain life for a while. And then he started to write some short stories and some plays, and then he gradually began to write poems too. And the kind of poetry he was writing, from his point of view, was completely out of touch with what most of the other people in Scotland were doing at that time. Most of the Scottish writers were either writing in Lalland's verse, which was a sort of artificially cultivated dialect poetry, or else they were writing a very conventional, stilted, academic kind of poetry. And Finlay set out to try to write something different, something fresh, something new. And in doing this, he looked outside of Scotland. He found himself reading people in other countries, and he was very interested in what a number of American poets were writing. And now I'm going to read some of his poems. And this is the title poem from The Dancers Inherit the Party. The dancers inherit the party. I've talked for an hour. I feel lousy. Not so when I have danced for an hour. The dancers inherit the party, while the talkers wear themselves out and sit in corners alone and glower. Now this next poem is Angles of Stamps. Stick a stamp at an angle on a letter. It means a kiss. Yes, but what sort of kiss? Is it a torn kiss? Sweet kiss? Anguished? Cool as water? Rowan burning kiss? Or kiss as pure as hawthorn? Of my typist, I asked, she being wise in mythology. Can you tell me, please, the proper angle to denote to my own true love that I love her most truly? Or do I expect a stamp to say what a kiss cannot? Sir, she said, I have no experience of your kisses. I have never met you in a meadow. I'm just a typist and a simple girl. A crooked stamp means a kiss, and so do little crosses. But whether you love your love as true as you say, only time will tell. Finlay spent, about a year and a half in the Orkneys, living on a little island, pretty much by himself, and pretty much a hand-to-mouth existence. A lot of his poems are about this time in the country, and he's written a lot of poems about the Orkneys. And this is one about the house he lived in on this little island in the Orkneys in Rousey. And this is Finlay's house, a wild stone on the floor, lots and lots of books, and a chair where you can't sit for, no, not the tar, the hooks. The lost fish hooks. Dried fish festoon the wall, and that stone sticks the door. Spiders spin in nooks. The visitors tend to fall. They trip first, then they fall. They catch on the lost fish hooks. I ought to shift that stone, but it seems easier to unscrew the door. Am I an awful man? I'm better housed than ducks, and I like to lose fish hooks. Well, that's Finlay's house on Rousey. And here's another out-of-door poem called Optimist. He used to go on fishing and camping trips with his father when his father was still alive. This is a poem about one of these. Optimist. My would-be father, old and slow, did buy himself a kind of tin can for brewing proper out-of-door tea in. The bloody fire, though, it wouldn't go. It was the bloody wet sticks and everything. Alone, he kneeled on the out-of-door grass, blowing with love. I remember how, home again, he brewed wild tea on the domestic gas. I think that poem illustrates one very nice and very characteristic and actually very rare thing in poetry that Finley achieves in that poem, that there's a very great simplicity of language, and yet the rhythm of the poem moves with great subtlety. There are funny things in it, and yet the poem is not a joke, because when he says blowing with love, it really is love in that, and yet at the same time he can laugh at the thing too, and it's this kind of balance between the two things, I think, is a very rare and a quality, and one that I admire very much in Finley's poems. Now, this is a slightly different one. Now, some of the words in this poem I can explain to you. Some of them are words that Finley's dreamed up out of somewhere, and probably from drinking too much strong Scotch tea. But it mentions the name of a town, Scrabster, which is a little fishing village right on the very north coast of Scotland, right opposite the Orkneys. This is quite an important fishing port there. And lobster fishing, of course, is one of the chief kinds of fishing they do there. And then there's a word peedy in it. And peedy is an Orkney word which means little or wee. The rest of it you'll have to manage for yourself. Catch. There once was a fisherman of Scrabster, caught in his pot a guy queer lobster. Thought he, this lobster's a sure seller. A tail it has, and a wee propeller. In fact, it's no ordinary lobster, felly. It looks far more like a peedy helly. You know, one kind of hobber lobster. What you call it? Helicapster. Aye, it's a peedy helicapster. There's lots are called in the sea off Scrabster. I'll read one more of Finley's poems. Now, this one is a completely straight poem. It doesn't have quite the humor that the others have in. And it contains one line which, in a way, focuses one of the things that Finley was trying to do in his poetry. And the third line in the poem says, a plain, becoming song. And it contains the idea of a simplicity and aptness and appropriateness of the language to what is being said. And I don't know how much of this I'll be able to get as I read it, but there is a curious awkwardness in the rhythm of the poem, almost as though it was being written by somebody who'd never quite written a poem before. But this is only just slight, and it gives a very a curious poignancy to what he is saying. He's talking about a little mill at Sauron under Kirfi Hill, which was on this island in the Orkneys. And this was a mill which had been abandoned. The mill wheel is stuck. But yet people are living in it still, and there are still things around it. Sauron Mill. Of such and such a simple thing, it is so sweetly hard to sing a plain, becoming song. As of this little leaning mill at Sauron under Kirfi Hill, it breathes of barley meal and never, ever turns its wheel. The waters through whose sluice will run a soft dark hair let loose. It stands on flowery shoes. Among flowers, gold and nettles fat, and from the shore, awry, it reels to every sunset sky with a high moss-green hat, from which at almost dawn will fly starlings to see the seals. Well, that's Sourin Mill in the Orkneys. And then the next poet I'd like to say a little about and read some of his poems is Anselm Hollow, whom we also published in a little pamphlet. Now, Hollow is a real migrant bird and cattle thief. I almost envy him. I've moved around a fair bit, but he's done far better than I have. He was born in Finland, grew up there, and was educated in Finland. He's in his late 20s now. I should mention his age. And lived in Germany for a while. Speaks German very well. He's now settled and living in London, where he's been for 5 or 6 years and works. He learned to speak English, speaks it, and writes it with an impeccable idiom that is really remarkable for somebody who has come from such an alien background. And as a result, he has at his disposal a whole wealth of poetic traditions which are really quite outside any English or American experience, and has published quite a number of translations of Finnish poetry, of German poetry, of Russian poetry. Some of you may have seen his Red Cats that City Lights have put out. He does he doesn't know too much Russian, but his mother speaks fluent Russian because many of the Finns learned this by necessity. So this is how he has access to the Russians. And what I thought I'd do was I'd like to read a couple of his translations from the Finnish and then some of his poems. I think you'll be able to see how some of the ways of feeling, way of organizing the poem and so on, even some of the rhythms, have come out of his Finnish translations into his English poems. One's tempted to think of a parallel for somebody writing in English who comes from such a foreign background, and I suppose Joseph Conrad is a comparable figure who grew up speaking and educated in Poland, but nevertheless learned English to write it with equal facility. And here are two two translations of his from the Finnish. I won't try to pronounce the names of the Finnish authors. I'm not any good at that. From the Winter Palace. Two women have I drawn for you on the dark field of night, but you are not tempted. I wonder, is it Helen whom you want, Ulysses bathed in her eyes? Who complained that Troy turned without giving warmth? Who complained, in this house fire freezes the bones? And what is this poem about? And what is a poem? And is this a poem? I bring to view a woman who looks past and at, carnivorous, a trap and a meal, with a soft appetite. Would she please? And what about this one? An overturned tortoise always struggles to get back onto its stomach, but this one does not even try. Would she not want to be a beautiful rose, closed up for the night? And the woman got out of the tub, bending under the weight of her hair, and on her shoulder appeared a quiet little dimple, disappeared. Her limbs were smiling. It is terrible always to move house, and in the end, you live alone with an old woman. There is no sad woman in the singular. No need to stop here. All is sad. And that's one of his poems from the Finnish. Well, here's another short one. Look at me, says the man. See my shadow. Guess it yourself. I am 12 feet tall and still growing. My wife grows, too. And listen, 3 came this week, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. How can one get a 4th child this same week? Friday, such big rockets. Tuesday, fireworks. Friday, they fall on England. Thursday, thank God. Tuesday, what happened to us now? The wife. Again, no weekend trip. And I want 12 children this very instant. Now, I'll read one of his own poems in English, and I think you'll see something of how he's been able to use this curious Finnish background of poetry in his own work. Sometimes I feel I do. Sometimes I feel I don't. Sometimes I feel with Alan Arch, poet of Arkansas, that we are the beautiful golden sunflowers of his sutra. Sometimes I feel we are cubical Mayan saints. For, according to Aldous Huxley, footnote, who, by the way, resurrected his golden and possibly even hairy accomplishment body from burial in blooms by perceptive peyote. According to him, footnote, in 1934, the year of my birth, let's make this personal while we're at it. According to him, a Mayan saint is a person who has been put through a cotton baler, as in order that it may fill a rectangular frame. The head must be flattened above and below, and steepened fore and aft. Footnote, a ship introduces itself with a cargo of granite for somebody's tomb. Demonstrators make their way to the harbor to demonstrate a new kind of beard. This poem is progressive, is not progressive, it is digressive. In a word, says Huxley, the Mayan saint's head must go through the cotton baler, beard and all. Sometimes I feel I do. Sometimes I feel I don't. Sometimes I feel like feeding that baler some of that granite while we are at it. So that's read one more of Hollow's poems. This is a very visionary poem, and when reading it, I'm aware of how two American poets have also drawn on the same material for somewhat similar purposes, Jerome Rosenberg and Robert Kelly, and others like that have also got many ideas in regard to poetry from some of the German poets that Hollow has translated. And this is a poem about the messenger. A messenger, bald, his skin burnt onto his bones, he appears on the sky rim, walking, not slowly nor fast, just walking. His bones move, his toe joints grip the ground. He has been on his way, he will soon arrive. We see him approach, we will see him arrive, we are his arrival. We will see how he opens his mouth. We will say, no, first, drink this. We will see how the water runs down into his sun-crumpled hide, filling out a few wrinkles. And he will open his mouth and deliver the message. What will he say? He will say what the one before him said. And the one before that, he will tell us, the dancers, they are surrounded by the burning. So simple, it hurts, and always the same. What else could it be? What else could the messenger say these days? The dancers,
in the midst of the burning. This is the messenger's voice, the sound of his horn, abandoned for lightness and speed. Now it lies in the sand, cracked by the heat, blackened, soon charred by the black heat.
To read a very different kind of poetry by an English poet, Michael Scherer. This is a long poem sequence called Persephone. Scherer comes to poetry largely from the poems of D.H. Lawrence, but and as I read, you will notice some of this, and he's also got a lot of ideas from some of the contemporary American poets. And this poem, I'd like to read just a little bit of an introduction to it about the kind of poem it tries to be. And Scherer wrote some notes in introduction to it, saying, "I find it flows along like a Bruckner symphony, long, repetitive, heavy, but with a kind of organic unity. Maybe that isn't much value. Anyway, there's a relaxed tone about it which has to be caught and surrendered to." And the technique of the poem is not to move to any particular objective in the poem, but to allow the ideas to find their own level. And I read just a little bit of it. It's a contemplative thing. Called Persephone. I have been on a journey. I have not known you, my country, your television aerial, your bright shirts, your vespers, your air of unself-critical assurance. Do I look at you or speak to you from such a distant land and across such weary gulfs, your incredible pettiness, your class, your opacity to thought? This is the best of Worcester, an early autumn evening, the air clear, the sky blue, the sun hot, and a breeze, the earth baked hard, and long dry flaxen stems waving above the cropped green grass. Small white of cotton wool stands high above Breeden in a clear sky. And the breezes bring a snatch of music from the ice cream van on the estate below. Nothing left but to write a masterpiece. It's lonely, damn lonely. Only one can talk this way, perhaps. Perhaps. Only this way. Perhaps contact and language are so fouled up that the heart can speak only this way. Innocence. Regaining of innocence. This, as I discover for the first time, the nest of wild hills, the end of the Malverns. All I was or have been. Emerging again. So simple. In a way, far simpler, less sophisticated, less literary than anything I had thought. The simplicity, rather, of the saint. A singleness. Not an all-comprehending vision or control of things. A singleness. As of this rock that defines the top of this hill. It is there. It has to be reckoned with. Stop there for a minute, and anybody wants to comes from a a manuscript called The Bird with Only One Wing. These are all poems written with a deliberate emphasis of trying to get away from the usual rather ponderous stance that so much poetry tends to have. And it's based on a line that occurs in one of Apollinaire's poems. I came across this line reading through the poem, and the line is sort of stuck in the poem. It seems almost at random. It doesn't have much to do with the poem, what goes before and what comes after. And Apollinaire says, there's a poem to be made on the bird with only one wing. But he doesn't elaborate any further on this. And as far as I know, he never made his poem on the bird with only one wing. So, of course, I decided I had to repair this gap. And I repaired it to the extent of 30 or 40 poems. And they're fun to write anyway. And these are some of the bird poems. Why don't you answer? There's one thing I'm sure of, if that bird would shut up. It's out of tune anyway, or my ear is no good. Of which I can tell you. Excuse me, eccentric. This cough is the dickens, and the fog last week. To tell you the truth, but can't you come closer? I don't like to shout, but don't crowd me either. The fact is, where had I got to? You hear what I'm saying? You're there, aren't you? Hey? This one is The Bird with Only One Wing, which I think you'll probably recognize as the fairly familiar thing that bothers all of us at one time or another. There's a poem to be made. The bird with only one wing flies any which way, migrating north, south, west at once, with only one leg, goes like a crutch, rat-tat-tat, on top of my head. With only one eye, blinks, stop, go, on the end of my nose when I want to work. With only one... Vertigo. It's a poem about writing, and you probably recognize the sensation. I sit at a table. I write. The world falls away from beneath me. The table remains, supporting the paper. The chair remains, supporting me. But to support the table and the chair, nothing. I dare not lift my pen. Dare not stop writing. Fortunately, there's still plenty of blank pages. My shoes seem to have come off. And the altitude, or more accurately, the depth beneath, seems to be increasing. I write faster. I think nostalgically of my carpet. Think even more dearly of the floorboards. With positive frenzy, I begin to dream about concrete blocks with steel piles sunk down into bedrock. I see myself, table and chair, as if in a convex mirror, receding into the distance. The poem I'm writing begins to revolve like a gyroscope. Another one about writing, too, called The Scratching Sound, obviously enough. The scratching sound, since you ask, comes from my fingernails, working at a small crevice which I've discovered in the plaster, beyond which, you don't have to tell me, there are probably bricks and even concrete. Certainly most of my time is taken up with routine or even compulsory activities, which is just as well, since my nails would never stand up to it for long at a time. And admittedly, there is an element of deliberate eccentricity. Since the scratching has a bizarre effect upon most of my companions, which does help to pass the time. Nonetheless, this particular crevice is far from exhausted. And, finally, I can see no other way out. This one's called A Fragment of Truth, which is an
handy thing to have. While working in the garden recently, I dug up a small fragment of truth. It was here and all over with clay and must have been buried for many years. But I recognized what it was almost at once. At first, we kept it on the mantelpiece in the living room, but it was often embarrassing because of visitors. I eventually put it on my desk in the study for a paperweight. I asked several close friends what they thought I ought to do with it. But no one was sure. Keep it for your children, some said. It's a great curiosity. Others suggested the local museum. It was too heavy to take with us when we went on holiday. While we were gone, someone broke into the house and stole it. Well, the police said they would make inquiries and asked me, could you identify it again as yours if you saw it? Perhaps. But now, I'm not sure if I do want it back. After all, if whoever it was should have found some use for it. I'll read one more of these. This one's called No Instructions. There were no instructions on the label. There were no instructions inside the box. Gone through the packing carefully, without finding a clue. And the postman refuses to take it back, saying, delivered to you correctly, no return address. Sorry, chum, but you've got it now. Yes, I've got it. I bought it. In fact, it begins to look as if I'd been properly had. I saw the announcement in the classified section. I sent away a money order for happiness. It sounded just what I wanted. And they sent me the complete kit as they promised, every bit, but without any instructions, not a word. Four, which is same type of poem, but the other side of the coin, if you'll see what I mean. It's called Learning to Breathe. It's a useful thing to learn, as you'll see from the poem. I've been learning to breathe underwater. Don't laugh. The flood level has already risen overhead and is still rising. It doesn't leave much time. Of course, I'm not the only one to be submerged. Several of my best friends have already drowned, and they sway here and there as the eddies carry them. Try not to look. To begin with, one is born with certain reflexes, and the nose rejects what it despises. So, I breathe through my teeth. The taste is not so much repulsive as cloying. Gradually the lungs fill up. It begins to seep into the circulation. The crucial moment. No good thinking it won't flow in your arteries. Oh, it does, only too easily. Concentrate rather on one cell in your brain. Keep that dry. Try to save the whole brain at once. You'll only end up by drowning. One synapse, even one cell, any cell, it's quite possible to survive. I'm learning to breathe, but it's slow work. As of today, I can breathe perhaps twice, or if I'm lucky, three times a month. Now, this may seem a negligible accomplishment, but then, perhaps the flood level hasn't risen so high in your part of the world as yet. I wanted to read one piece here about a place in England of which I'm very fond. This is a very straight landscape poem, and it's about a place near Worcester called Breedon Hill. Breedon Hill is not a very big hill, but it stands out in the surrounding countryside. And, in the past, quite a lot of writers have written about it one way or the other. There's quite a bit of history around it and so on. And it's, as I say, it's a name that has some meaning in there. And this poem is not one that I feel, as far as structure is concerned, is very satisfactory, but
it has an interest for me and I hope for you in trying to feel its way around, trying to make something out of this. Here is this hill, this is Breeden Hill. We look at it, we see it, we think about it, and so on and so on. What can we make in writing out of this? And the poem goes at it in several different ways throughout the course of the poem. It's called A Hill. Black upon orange, a profile of giant rubble. For a moment, it barricades the sun. Orange, out of black, a foliage of wrinkled copper. For a moment, dawn germinates in a furrow of the hill. The phrases are apt. The scene is not unusual. The joy is in the attention. The description is not a circumscribed likeness, that is, of any delimited hill. It is not that, nor is it exactly at random. The description portrays a hill, which is discovered in the action, an unknown hill, which becomes known, which is a likeness, and which becomes likely. It is Breeden Hill, a name, but not that. Then, is it a whale? Dark indigo, partly submerged, the dorsum crusted with shellfish? Or is it Mount Baden, with King Arthur and the company of the table and the last outpost of empire? Or asleep, folded upon itself, eyelids and mouth sunk into forehead and cheek, an old man taking a nap? Or awake, a heraldic beast crouched, its nostrils alert for the Malverns, its eyes fixed far beyond into the hills of Wales? Or an old family, the Savages, their 17th century bones in the church at a village under the garish monuments newly repainted? Or is it archaeologists from Birmingham digging in the earthworks near Overbury, excited by pottery fragments, defining pit dwellings in the chalk? Or is it a young couple who have modernized an old cottage with a Van Gogh print in the living room? Or is it the damp, dew dripping through the bracken, oozing slick upon clay and flint, delicately settling in microscopic drops on the backs of the sheep between the twisted filaments of wool? Or an afternoon, yet to come, a picnic with sandwiches and cider, the children running happy on the turf, with bees in the gorse and a slight sunburn. And it is not, and it is. The description accumulates. The attention becomes explicit. The hill has become familiar. Oh, it has become a description, not a hill. But it declares a hill, a very particular hill, a remarkable hill, a hill which it is possible to know.